Hello and welcome to Healing from Within. I am your host, Cheryl Glick, author of The Living Spirit, which shares a look at universal energy, healing, spiritual communication, and ways to awaken to higher consciousness for achieving true human and divine potential. Today I am delighted to welcome Peg O'Connor, author of Life on the Rocks, Finding Meaning in Addiction and Recovery, which is the first book to address addiction and recovery from a Western philosophical perspective, ultimately showing us that philosophy is more than an academic subject. It is really a way for life and a quest for meaning. Hello, Peg. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Cheryl.
Peg, as listeners of this show are well aware, my guests and I share our personal experiences and insights into the world of thought, energy healing, and communication in order to integrate new perspectives for developing our spiritual and human gifts so we can evolve and improve the quality of our life and face challenges with the necessary tools for fostering personal development and growth. In today's episode of Healing from Within, Peg O'Connor, who is professor of philosophy and gender, women, and sexuality studies at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota, will begin by taking us back to the ancient Greek roots of philosophy as care for the soul, while illuminating many issues addicts and their loved ones face, as indeed do we all, and that is self-identity, moral responsibility, self-knowledge, self-deception, free will and determinism, fatalism, the nature of God, and our relationship to each other. Peg, I always love to ask my esteemed guests to think back to childhood and a person, a place, event or dream that was important to them and which may have shown them their life path or destiny that was already in place at the beginning. For I believe the imprint for who we will grow to be is already there within us. So think back for a minute when you were a kid, if there was anything that resonated that was important to you.
Well, it's funny you should say that. One of the things I like the most about my book is the dedication, in part because I can so hear my father's voice, as he would frequently say something to me, and it was all the kind of affirmation that I needed. So I'll read you the dedication. That'll give you a sense.
Oh, please do. Yeah. Good.
To my parents, Ann and Jack, for always giving me your blessing and support to become whatever the hell I want to be. That's vintage my father. Do whatever the hell you want to do.
How lucky you were to have him. How lucky you were to have him. Because, you know, modern day parents right now, they're sort of called helicopter parents. They hover over their children and they're really trying to protect them from life. And you really can't learn unless you have your own experiences, right? So you need someone who says to you, go, you know, be free.
Go. Do it.
Fly.
Try it.
Try it. What do you have to lose?
Exactly. You know, and it's funny. It's not even the helicopter parents that are the problem anymore. It's what we call the snowplow parent. The snowplow parent is the one who is going to clear everything out of the path of his or her child, which is different from hovering. It's significantly different from hovering. So my parents always gave me the sense that, you know what, I can use my education, the great gift of education that my parents gave me, and I will figure out what it is that I want to do, and that I can do whatever I put my mind to it, and that I should love what I do. And, you know, my dad was an attorney. He loved practicing law. He absolutely loved it. So that was a great role model for me. Make sure you love what you do as your work, as your career, because we live in a culture in which work will fill every waking moment if you let it. So that's the whole thing about balance. I have to love my work, and I also have to have a whole bunch of other interests and concerns and loves to keep it in balance so I don't tip the scales too much on one side.
Right, and also, you know, if you have a parent who allows you just to be and to find things in your own way, I had parents like that. They really could step back, and they also said, what do you have to lose? When fear would creep into me and I wouldn't want to try something, I always remember my mother saying, well, what do you have to lose? If you don't try, you'll never have that new experience and something to gain. So we were
and
very
that's a great
fortunate.
Gift.
Yes, great
you
gift.
Know, and I think for my mother, a sense of humor. My mother loves to laugh, and she loves to laugh at herself and not take herself too seriously. And that really was a lesson for me, not to take myself too seriously. I have to take myself seriously in the right ways and at the right times. But, oh, my gosh, if I ever lost the ability to laugh at myself, I really would not know how to go on in the world.
And that's,
I really don't know.
You know.
I don't know what to do with people who don't have a sense of humor. I can't find my way with them. They're like a different life form.
Right. And Peg, you really are the author of several books, Morality and Our Complicated Form of Life and Responsibility. And you were just talking about taking responsibility for what's important and allowing the rest to be humorous and light. So I like that very much. And why did you write Life on the Rocks?
I wrote Life on the Rocks because I finally decided that I needed to bring two important parts of my identity together, that they really did inform one another, but I hadn't really given it proper attention. So a quick thumbnail version of my story. I am a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for a very long time. I was one of those people who started drinking really young as a teenager, and I was lucky, fortunate, however you want to describe that, to quit drinking when I was still in my early 20s. And I'm a philosopher by training. My training is in moral philosophy. And what I realized, looking back, is that philosophy really helped me, I think, to get sober and to stay sober, because it gave me this incredible treasure chest of concepts and questions and concerns about asking myself. So that's the kind of self-examination, the self-interrogation of who am I and what do I want to be and how am I showing up in the world, and is there a disjunction between who I say I want to be and who I actually am, and how do I take responsibility? And sort of this is one of my I guess it's an axe to grind, my way to think about responsibility. Responsibility, as most people talk about it, gets flattened down to be about blame. And blaming is just a tiny, tiny fraction of what responsibility genuinely is. And oftentimes we think about taking responsibility as it being onerous or terrible or about accepting fault or blame. And for me, taking responsibility is very liberating. And it is very exciting to think about moving forward. I have responsibilities to myself and to other people, to the world in general, and I'm fortunate enough, I have the great privilege to get to take them. So I best be able to identify what they are.
Yeah, and you know, Peg, responsibility for me is what we're really here as souls to learn. It is the way for self-investigation, self-motivation, creation of beauty and goodness within ourselves and shedding it out to the world. So responsibility is growth. It's learning. It's living is really what it is. And, you know, it's really funny. When I was in college, I was very interested in philosophy because I had a question. What is this all about? Who are we? Where do we come from? Where do we go when we die? I studied religion. I studied literature. I studied philosophy. And I had questions, but I really didn't find the answers till much later in life when I started to have some mystical experiences and realized I was seeing life through belief systems and through other people's ideas. But when I had my own mystical experiences, I realized that we were very much more than the physical body and physical reality. and we're universal creatures, or so universal conscious beings who are always evolving and changing. And then I had a bit of the answer that I was looking for when I was younger, but it didn't come through someone else's book or story. It came through my own story. So people out there who are listening have to find it through their own experiences and trust themselves and be responsible enough to allow themselves to see the truth within them. So
here's an interesting thing, though. One of my favorite poets is Rilke. And in his letters to a young poet, this young man writes to him because he's all angsty about true love and what will he do, and, you know, just that kind of incredible deep concern that young people have. We all have it. And one of the wonderful things that Rilke says is, live the questions now. Perhaps you will someday, without noticing it, live the answers. Because when you're really young, you might not recognize something as an answer. You're just not ready for it. You're not mature enough. And, you know, it's interesting. That's a similar kind of refrain that pops up in Plato, you know, writing around, you know, 380 BCE. I mean, he argued that really young people aren't ready yet to do serious philosophy. They're not mature enough. Now, I disagree in some ways about that. I think it's important. Philosophy really helps to frame questions that are questions that you can be animated by your entire life. That's one of the values of philosophy.
I think so, yeah. But tell us, what is philosophy? And then we'll get an idea of maybe it's very much more, and young people are approaching it, but they still don't understand the whole bigger picture yet, but they are interested in an understanding bigger than the reality at the moment. So tell us, what is philosophy?
So for my mind, this is someone who was a philosophy undergraduate and who went to grad school in philosophy and has now been teaching philosophy for 20 years in a liberal arts context. I understand philosophy drawing from the ancients, so Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, that philosophy is an activity that is best done in the company of others, and that philosophy is very much an engaged inquiry and set of commitments about how a person is in the world and how they are related to other particular individuals and to the broader communities and city-states or nations. And that the earliest form of philosophy as practiced by Socrates was about self-examination or self-interrogation. I mean, Socrates famously said, as he is in the penalty phase of his trial, having been found guilty of corrupting the youth of Athens, and having the death penalty on the table, he's offered kind of a deal, a nudge-nudge, wink-wink, hey, go live in exile, Socrates, and just shut up for now. And Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. He would rather die than not be able to engage in the kind of inquiry that prompted people to question themselves and to question authority. Philosophy can be remarkably subversive, because philosophy has always been concerned with trying to demarcate the line between appearance and reality and asking about knowledge. And when you think about the society in which we live in which knowledge, particularly scientific knowledge, is king, I want more people who are able to ask critically informed questions, such as, why should we accept that premise in an argument? Why should we assume that because something is this way, that it must be this way, or that it should be those ways? So, those are some of the first philosophical questions that you get. And I want to say, boy, howdy, do those have an important role to play right now in our world.
Absolutely. Look what's happening with the presidential election. Look at all the young people who are stepping up to the plate, because they know that Socrates and Plato and Aristotle were concerned with living a good life and living a life from your own perspective, not what people wish to perhaps ram down your throat in the course of saying that it's right when it may not be right for everyone. So I kind of think, in a way, philosophy and spiritualism are similar, as spiritualism seeks to know the self and its connection to universal life and how to live according to the values of energy and soul wisdom. So there's a great connection
there's
here.
There's a big connection there. And, you know, there's a connection in a particular philosopher, psychologist, physician, William James, writing in the early 1900s, The Varieties of Religious Experience. So when you were talking about having your mystical experience, it sounds like one of the conversion stories that James talks about.
Mm-hmm.
So James is regarded as the founder of the academic discipline of psychology here in the United States. And he believes in mysticism. He believes in psychic events. And yet he's also this empiricist. And he's quite clear that there are different explanatory frameworks. And it turns out there's a whole lot that science can't explain. And it turns out that there are all these different ways to make meaning and value, but at the end of the day, in the varieties of religious experience, James is really concerned with the spiritual beliefs and practices of individuals. It's a wonderful book. If people are looking for a great piece of exciting philosophy to read that really is encyclopedic, he wrote this, it was a series of lectures that came out in 1902. And he's got all these examples from Buddhist traditions,
mm-hmm.
from Muslim,
yes.
from different strands of Christianity, from the Quakers, the Anabaptists. He had to go out and find that information. It's not like doing a Google search,
well,
and it's wonderful in that way.
Everybody has, in their own way, in their own time, hope to lift up their consciousness instead of remaining in a state where we accept things. We open ourselves up to creating new things and new possibilities, and anything is possible if you don't
yep.
live in the fears and limitations of other people's mm-hmm. ways. So that's what it's all about. Now, how does your book address recovery? Let's get back to the addiction. And
let's get back to the addiction piece there, sure.
Yes.
So I believe that there are multiple paths into addiction, that addictions may share overlapping, crisscrossing traits and characteristics, but there's no one trait that runs throughout all addictions. There's no what we call a necessary condition. And that each person's addiction is unique in some ways because each of us is unique, but again, with shared strands, similarities, crisscrossing, and overlapping. My belief is that there have to be as many paths out of addiction as there are into addiction. And if there's not, we're going to have a problem. And we also have to recognize that people's needs in treatment or needs in recovery change over time because we're constantly changing.
Absolutely.
And that people can get stuck. People can get stuck in saying, well, I must do this. This is my program, or this has always worked in the past, in which I want to say all those ads about financial planners that, you know, past performance does not guarantee future returns.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. If you're not mindful of your recovery process. So a couple of particular philosophers are really relevant here. One is the philosopher I worked the most on professionally, Ludwig Wittgenstein. He's regarded as arguably the most influential 20th century philosopher. So he lived between 1888 and 1952.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he talks about how it is that one has to make a passionate commitment to a way of life or to a certain kind of framework. And I see recovery as a passionate commitment both to understanding yourself and being in the world in certain kinds of ways where you are no longer enslaved or beholden to the substances or behaviors that had kept you in chains before. So that notion of passionate commitment is really crucial. Another philosopher who factors in importantly, another one of my patron saints, is Søren Kierkegaard, the great Danish existentialist. He was the one who talks about having to make a leap of faith, that in some ways, recovery is making a leap of faith particularly if everything points to the fact that you've relapsed, you've relapsed, you've relapsed, you've relapsed. You don't want to give in to the fatalism and think, therefore, it must always be this way. It can never be different. But are you willing to make a leap of faith? I think it comes back to your question that your mom asked you, what do you got to lose?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you already keep relapsing. And then there's Nietzsche writing around the turn of the late 19th century. And he's got this wonderful question, and it's called The Myth of the Eternal Return. What if at every point in your life, let's imagine, a demon comes to you in the middle of the night and says, you have to live your life exactly over and over again for all eternity, and I will pop up at exactly the same point in all of eternity, in every single one of your lifetimes. And you would have to choose, would you live this life over again or not? Would that possibility strike abject terror in your heart, or would nothing make you rejoice more? And so for me, when I think about my life, would I live it over again and again and again and have to make that choice to live it over and over again for all of eternity? I say yes. And I think people who have really good recovery say yes too, even as they have taken responsibility for what they have done and maybe the harms and hurts that they have caused other people and that they have caused themselves.
Or the hurts that they have received. That have been inflicted upon them. Yeah.
Absolutely. But you still say, this is my life and I take responsibility for it. And yes, I would do it again.
And I'm with you. And you know, I am a Reiki practitioner, energy healer, and medium. And when people come to me for sessions, many times they say to me, I don't want to do this again. I say, well, learning goes on. Life goes on. You will have other experiences beyond this time and place, and you'll always be creating something new. So to say, you know, that you don't want to come back, well, you may not have a choice about that. You may have
And you can rail against it, or you can accept it.
Right, accept it, and you can embrace the challenge, and you can enjoy it instead of finding the negativity. But we were talking before about a person's needs in recovery change as he or she changes, and we're changing every moment of every second of our life. And you wrote something that I liked a lot that I'd like our listeners to hear. Philosophers would suggest that the happiest life is the virtuous life, and only those who have the right sort of concern for their character can achieve this. So friends matter importantly to one's character and happiness. Our friends can make us better. The wrong friends can also make us worse off. Any addict would say the same. Well, that's true of everybody in life. That if you find people who are open-minded and open-hearted, they lift you up. And if you have a support team around you who encourages you, like we were talking about at the beginning of the show, we were fortunate enough to have parents and family that allowed us to express ourselves in the way that was uniquely ours. So I would say I liked what you wrote, and it is true. We have to be aware of what we are creating with our own thoughts and actions. And in regard to this uniqueness, we also talked about uniqueness before, to each individual and situation and the many ways to discover yourself. And in my book, The Living Spirit, I wrote, will you take the ride to your personal reality and become more of the intuitive individual you were born to be? Will you seek to understand yourself and those around you in a more profound, gratifying way? Will you eliminate such unnecessary sadness, anger, and fear, and replace it with more joy, acceptance, gratitude, and love? You do not have to accept this challenge. God gave us free will over our own lives. However, if you do choose to accept the challenge this time around, you must begin to entertain new ways of viewing your energetic thoughts and actions and improve the quality of your presence in the world. If you do this simple task, you will ultimately see the world change and shift into a new and better reality, not only for yourself, but ultimately for the generations to follow. And I think that's what we're talking about here. I think that's how
I think we are.
Philosophy, taking responsibility, getting to know yourself, because it's hard to know another person if you don't even know yourself, is the way to go forward. And that's where we always are moving, in a forward.
We better be moving forward because we know where we've been.
So let's go on to another question. Do you think drug use, for our listeners out there, is always a form of escapism?
I don't always think it's a form of escapism.
I don't know.
Many times, but I mean that. So I teach. I'm on a college campus, and you know, alcohol is the number one drug on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And any college, any school that doesn't start with the fact that drinking can be an incredibly fun and social activity is not going to be able to address it very well. And you know, that's the truth of it. And students bond around alcohol, and some of them have a ton of fun. But then that ton of fun becomes less fun, less fun, less fun, and more problematic. But, it turns out that the social dimensions of drinking and drug use on campuses are crucial components of it. You're away from home for the first time, and then suddenly your dorm is, you know, sneaking out, or someone's got beer in their room when they shouldn't. I mean, the importance of connection. Here's this whole point about making friends again, right? I mean, that, well, yeah, you can start hanging out with the wrong crowd, and that can become a problem.
Well,
that
also, there's the thought that sometimes drinking is a choice, and then if we take it as a disease, a person can have one drink, and they could have an addiction to it almost immediately because the conditions of their body, the chemistry of their body might work that way. So whether it's a disease, many people tend to think of it that way, or a choice, it really doesn't matter. It's a form of, again, getting to know ourselves and being able to do the best we can with whatever circumstance extends out of however it started. Right, but we hope that young people, if they find right away that they're not able to do well with it, get help, because it shouldn't be controlling you. If it's something you do for enjoyment and once in a while to expand your consciousness, then it could be okay. But if it gets to be automatically something you can't control that makes you feel not well or happy or be productive, then it is a disease, and then you need to find people to help you. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
Well, I would agree that when it becomes something that you can't control, you become enslaved to it. And, you
right.
know, the word addiction, really what it meant was in ancient Roman times that one person would be addicted to another in the sense of having been given over to another in repayment for a debt. So with addiction, a person gives him or herself over to some master.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I think, a really interesting way to think about it.
Very good, yes. And we want to be our own master, and we don't want to have to give ourselves or pieces of our soul away. So I want to thank you, Peg O'Connor, for a new and creative way to approach addiction and indeed all our life challenges, with a look at the philosophical thoughts of ancient and modern teachers who really explore the quality of our human soul and the search for happiness over sadness and joy over suffering, which can only be accomplished by knowing yourself and pursuing the search for goodness, beauty, and love within. In order to learn more about these thoughts, go to psychologytoday.com/exper/peg-o'connor-phd. In summarizing today's episode of Healing From Within, Peg O'Connor has given us much to think about in terms of the addictions and behaviors which adversely affect our success in mastering our emotions and creating a life of purposefulness, joy, and growth. We find in the search for meaning in life about who we are and where we come from, a similarity to the addict who is in search of those same answers. For in the lack of knowing and the pain and fear that a physical life imposes on each of us, we cannot completely understand what is expected of us or what we wish to find in our own lives. And addicts may be almost entirely a curiosity to non-addicts. It is much the same for each of us to understand another person, as it is difficult to even understand many of our own issues and inclinations. It is better to recognize our uniqueness and be open to whatever transpires for us, and to think of events as opportunities for our complete spiritual, emotional, physical, psychological, and social evolution. And in regard to this thought, Peg wrote, "There may be significant comprehension problems between addicted populations as well. An alcoholic may not understand food addiction, and the food addict cannot make sense of someone who would be addicted to heroin. There's more blah, blah, blah happening here. Peg and I would have you try to be understanding of your fellow citizens and their differences, problems, addictions, limitations, and fears, and spend more time recognizing our similarities and needs to help one another. In the end, we are all just energy beings here for a while to experience the physical world of choice and possibilities. I am Cheryl Glick, host of Healing From Within, and invite you to visit my website, CherylGlick.com, to read and listen to the metaphysical leaders, authors, and healers share a look at ways to enhance and enjoy life without limitation or design. Shows may also be heard on DreamVision7Radio.com or WebTalkRadio.net. Thank you.